Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Poo Wang, who is Helene and Alvin Allen Chair in Literature at Brandeis University, where he's also an assistant professor in Chinese literature. And he'll be talking about his book, The Translatability of Revolution, Guo Mo Ruo and 20th Century Chinese Culture, which was published in 2018 by Harvard University Asia Center. With the world connected like never before, the translatability or untranslatability of ideas and concepts across borders and between languages is as current a topic as ever. One complication today, as people in East Asia, the West, and myriad other locations try to communicate, is the fact that our conversations have to operate through many accreted layers of previous translations. When a Chinese person talks to a German, an American, a Kenyan, or anyone from anywhere else, about the government or society or history, how can anyone be sure whether they've reached a common understanding? Pu Wang's book sheds light on just such highly relevant themes, but the translatability of revolution is about a great deal more than this. Being not only the first full study of the whole life of Guo Mo Ruo, a man whom Deng Xiaoping eulogized as a writer, poet, dramatist, Marxist historian, paleographer, revolutionist, and cultural fighter, this is a work which delves deep into questions of intercultural and interlinguistic contact, friction, and accommodation, showing the centrality of such concerns to revolutionary politics and to modern China specifically. Wang's skills in weaving together Guo's extraordinarily voluminous and diverse work, from translations of Goethe and Shelley to interpretations of Shang oracle bones, and the enormous scope of the book must owe something to the author's own compound identities as a poet, translator, and a professor, as I mentioned, of Chinese literature. At once personally intimate and very broad in scope, this book goes well beyond the life of one man to paint a revealing picture of Chinese culture in the age of revolution and the innumerable influences that shaped it, from ancient Chinese script and poetry through German and English Romanticism, Soviet politics, and the harsh material realities of modern urban life and warfare. But in any case, the author himself will do a much better job of describing all this and bringing it all together. So I'll say, Poo Wang, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ed. Thank you so much for having me on this podcast channel of New Books in East Asian Studies.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. But I guess your own background, as I mentioned, is pretty relevant to this whole project. So perhaps I could begin by asking you to provide us with a bit of a sort of self-archaeology, something about your own background.
Oh, wow, yeah.
How you got interested in Guo Mo Ruo and questions of translation.
Yeah, Guo Mo Ruo is a project that has everything to do with my own kind of intellectual formation. I received my BA and MA at Peking University, also known as Beida. And in my training, my main focus was modern Chinese poetry. And I was an active campus a poet and literary organizer. And that's where I started to be highly interested in the modernist tradition of Chinese poetry in the 20th century. But in my PhD training at NYU, my interest shifted towards the question of translation, and especially the question of translation in relations to the theme of revolution in the Chinese context. So eventually, I end up with the question of Guo Moruo because Guo Moruo's work, as controversial as it be, is the best example of this combination and tension between translation and revolution.
I see, I see. And in terms of your own, you know, your personal activities, as you mentioned, as a poet back at your time in Beida, has that continued through to your life in the US, in New York, and now at Brandeis too?
Yes, I continue to write, continue my work as a creative poet. But the thing I would like to mention is that I only write in Chinese, and I will never try my hands on poetic translation, especially after studying Guo Moruo, because I realize how challenging it is to be a poetic translator. But I am working as an academic translator. I'm currently translating Walter Benjamin's critical biography into Chinese.
Oh, right. Wow. And that's for sort of market back in China. I mean, your translations into Chinese are for a Chinese audience predominantly.
Yes. And this seems to be a kind of a translation theory, ABC. That is, you can only translate into your native town. You can never translate out of your native town. And in that regard, I will call Guo Moruo as a kind of a colleague of mine, but Guo Moruo had a more ambitious kind of career dealing with poetic translation, an area, as you may imagine, is highly controversial in any language. Yeah,
sure. Yeah, and we'll get onto that in a sec. But actually, your link there to Guo Moruo brings me to, I guess, one final question I have out of curiosity about your own work. Of course, Guo's career was transformed by moving around a great deal, by spending time in Japan and many other places that we'll discuss. But I just wonder, how has your own creative output shifted by being based in the United States compared to when you were back in China? Do you feel like there are different thematic focuses that arise because
definitely.
Of that location?
I think that's definitely the case. And living and studying in the United States brought a totally new dimension to my creative writing, and a totally kind of a different self-consciousness of writing in Chinese as a poet. And I am still kind of struggling with this kind of interesting situation in which I find myself, that is writing a Chinese modernist poetry in an English-speaking world that is a kind of a typical global a scenario of a transit travel and an intimate unconscious self-translation.
So you find your kind of everyday cultural experiences.
And also it's about every part of our existence as a linguistic animal. I think that is I deal with the bilingual situation in my classroom, in my own life, at home, at work, and everywhere. So and of course that's a very intimate part. I don't want to be fully conceptual about. But definitely, that's very important right now to my own kind of work as a poet, and I think that is a kind of a global situation for all of us. That is, we are all living in a condition of translation, invisible translation and visible translation. And I don't think being lost in translation is a bad thing. I started to really appreciate that kind of a life experience.
That's wonderful. And I think there's something deeply anthropological there too, in a sense.
That, right, you know, exactly. Kind
of,
yeah.
You're living every day. The subject of your work is somewhat difficult to disentangle from your everyday life.
Exactly.
But we'll jump into that subject now, I think, and
great.
The book itself. You begin with an introduction which sets out some of the main ideas and also gives us an outline of Gwor's life. As mm-hmm. you've already alluded to, he's a pretty complex figure and someone who has been subject to no shortage of controversy. And so I wonder if actually you could just begin by giving us painting a bit of a picture of Gwor, the man, and the creative force and the translator and everything else. Could you just outline his bio actually to start us off?
Sure. Yeah. You know, like I mentioned, I started to read Gwor Mo Ruo when I was a college student because he was a must read as he was a founding figure of Chinese modern Chinese poetry, that is vernacular free verse Chinese poetry. He started as this lyrical champion of modern Chinese romanticism, and he ended up being Mao Zedong's last poetic interlocutor. And that trajectory itself was something really kind of controversial in every sense. And in addition, he also emerged in the middle of his career as a leading, a pioneering Marxist historian. And his contribution to the studies of oracle bones and bronze inscriptions totally changed the field of interpretative archaeology in China. In addition, he's devoted almost three decades of his life to translating Goethe's Faust into Chinese. And then that's where I was totally kind of astonished by the scope of his work. But in the meantime, I was totally fascinated with it because I realized if you want to study poetry, translation, history, and revolution, wow, that's the place to start.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And so he was. Yeah, could you give us a bit more of a sense of where was he born and where did he study and what was kind of going on in his early life that set him off?
Yeah, and Gwor Mo Ruo's own life and I would call it a life story has itself become a myth of modern Chinese literature and culture. In both a good sense and a bad sense, because he wrote a lot of biographical work. So my storyline owes a lot to his own kind of self glorification. So he was born in the Sichuan province in mm-hmm. a provincial town and into a very wealthy countryside merchant family. So he received a half modern, half traditional education because he lived in the age, he was born in 1892, so he lived in the age of the decline and the final collapse of the last imperial dynasty of China, that is Qing Dynasty. Mm. So when he was a high school student, the Qing Dynasty was overthrown by the revolutionaries, and he witnessed the founding of the first Republic of China. And then escaping a family and of the arranged marriage, he tried to seek higher education in Japan. There he stayed for almost 10 years for his higher education. So he learned Japanese and he became a medical student at Imperial University, the best public university system back then in Japan, on the Kyushu campus. Mm. And because he was a medical student, he learned Latin and German. That's how you became a doctor back then in Japan. And his textbooks for German language actually was German literature of Goethe and Schiller. And there he also met his true love, first love, and he got into this common law marriage with a Japanese young girl, and a love story that will lead to a lot of controversy as well.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, we'll perhaps revisit that in a second. But I just wonder, you mentioned there that this pretty interesting context in which he was a medical student, as you say, and someone who was learning German for medical purposes, but via classic literature.
Sure.
Or texts which today are certainly considered classic works of German literature. Is your impression of him that he was a sort of linguistic prodigy? Was he, do you think, exceptionally talented when it came to something as simple as, or not simple, but something as kind of fundamental as language acquisition, mastering Japanese, German, English, or how did he manage all of this, do you think? Was it more to do with just being needing to because of the circumstances, or was he a very talented linguist in your personal impression?
You know, well, when I finished this book, when I started to try to sell this book to a lot of scholars and colleagues who are pretty critical of Gomorrah's life, especially when it comes to Gomorrah's political decisions, they were kind of surprised by my focus on this controversial figure, but they will always concede one point, that is, Gomorrah is a genius. Gomorrah, in my view, for me, you know, from a totally biographical perspective, I was totally amazed by the fact that how fast he learned certain languages, and how fast he was as a literary translator. And I will give you three examples. So when he went to Japan to try to seek opportunities of higher education, he had zero Japanese, except some kind of very limited exposure to Japanese courses back in his high school years. That was his last chance of receiving a scholarship. So he worked really hard. And then he made a huge turnaround, and a really fast turnaround, when he succeeded in the entrance exam for the government stipends of Imperial University system. So by government stipends, that's a kind of agreement between Japanese imperial government and the Chinese Republic government back then. So if you pass that examination, you will receive government scholarship. So that was the first time, you know, we see Gomorrah as a really fast learner of language. The other example is totally different. That is his work on the classical language. That is, he, according to his autobiography, he spent in a time frame of less than 4 months, he finished the studies of all the works of pre-existing scholarships on oracle bones inscriptions, and he started to decipher the oracle bones inscriptions himself, and he succeeded in many cases. This is totally surprising for many experts, but of course we could find some kind of reasons, because he was already well versed in traditional Chinese for sure. He had a really solid philological education, but think about that. Oracle bones were the most important archaeological discovery of 20th century China. So it was, back then, it was recently unearthed and recovered from many sources. And Gomorrah was not trained as a scholar. He was a poet. He was a political activist. And when he wanted to try his hands on historical materials as a Marxist, all of a sudden he emerged as a major kind of contributor to this new field.
Go ahead.
And, you know, in terms of his German, I think he might be, that's the last example I will give. He might have been a poor German speaker, but his German reading knowledge and his appreciation of German literature, culture, and history was just amazing. And in that regard, I think he could also be seen as another kind of path breaker in Chinese scholarship on German literature.
Well, that's pretty fascinating stuff, as you say, especially given this somewhat complicated legacy and kind of post hoc judgments that much of scholarship has reached about him, or indeed of public opinion has come to think of him within China and among those who have studied Chinese culture and politics in the 20th century.
Sure.
He died in 1978, and what has his, I mean, you've already alluded to it a little, but could you say something more about his legacy and interpretations of his life and where some of these controversies have come from and why he's been seen as something of a complex, at best, figure?
Sure, yeah. And of course, from this kind of life scope, we can see, you know, Guo Moruo had a long life. And his life story was in perfect overlapping with the whole period of so-called short century of Chinese Revolution, the most transformative period of 20th century China. That is the period from the May 4th period to the end of the Cultural Revolution. So he even survived the Cultural Revolution. And the most important aspect of his life was not only about this overlapping with this age, but also because of his total embrace of the period of revolution. So he made the decisive turn to the left in the second half of 1920s. And when the Communist Party membership meant the risk of life due to the split of the first alliance between the Communist and Nationalist in 1927, he applied for Communist membership in the same year. And then he had the 10-year exile in Japan because he was one of the most wanted political, quote-unquote, criminals by the nationalist government of Jiang Zemin, even though he worked as Jiang Zemin's secretary. And then he was deeply involved in the second alliance of the nationalist and communist, the anti-Japanese alliance. But in this alliance, he played a decisively pro-communist role. And here, the most controversial period of his life started. That is, he was promoted by the Communist Party as the flag bearer of "quote unquote" progressive culture of China, and he was elected as the president of the inaugural president of Academy of Science after the founding of the People's Republic. He was the vice chairman of the People's Congress. For a brief period of time, he was also a vice premier. And he decided to support all the major projects and agendas of Mao Zedong. Mm-hmm. And he decided to do a thorough self-criticism at the very beginning of the Cultural Revolution. And finally, he decided to stick to this Maoist ideal of revolution toward the end of his life. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, especially when we read Mao Zedong's poetic conversations with Guo Moruo, it is safe to say that Guo Moruo's work, Guo Moruo's intellectual contribution to Maoism helped establish the cult of personality of Mao. So many scholars and critics who are extremely extremely critical of the Maoist legacies in China would like to see Guo Moruo as not only a kind of a major player in Maoist culture, but also see him as a kind of opportunist in the ever-changing political climate in Mao's China. So there you can imagine how controversial it is.
Yeah, no, that I think those kinds of associations, yeah, understandably, are not to everyone's liking by any means. But I think that's a real strength of this book. As you point out yourself, previous biographies, of which there have been a couple, usually stop quite early on in his career.
Sure, but, yeah.
In a way, by periodizing it as you do, and I really like this kind of framing as you have it, of the long Chinese Revolution running from May the 4th up to 49 and even beyond, and also this short 20th century, which you kind of also highlight that is contained within those years of sort of tumult and revolution in China, perhaps ending in the after the death of Mao.
Sure.
But I think in tackling all of this long life of Guo, you are taking on something that is understandably a pretty daunting prospect, given the controversies and just the anyone involved in anything for so long during this period in China was going to be doing a very large amount of pretty, going to have to do a lot of pretty mad stuff. One would suggest. So,
yeah,
I think it's a great project because you take on everything. And perhaps we should get into it now, having got a bit more of a picture of your take on Guo the man and his life.
Sure.
So the book is divided into two parts, which respectively deal with translation and translation of both foreign works and of ancient Chinese literature and so on. And then secondly, part two treats historical interpretation and some of this more, conceptual questions of historiography and also the place of some of his work on classical poetry and so on in forming his sort of revolutionary ideas and also literary output. But we'll start with the first part. And you begin us in chapter one with some questions of his poetry, and specifically, I really like this image you conjure up of him using apostrophe in poetry, addressing poems that start by addressing something directly, oh, something, this kind of poetic form. And him as almost like a shaman conjuring up inanimate objects in the modern society, bringing them to life. So can we get into more detail perhaps, or could you give us something, a picture of the interaction between his poetic processes in some of these poems you highlight from earlier in his life and the Chinese politics that he is getting involved in?
Sure, yeah. So in the first part, and also especially in chapter one, I really want to lay the foundation of a lyrical politics that I think that would really help us understand not only Guo Moruo's life work, but also the condition under which the Chinese Revolution was always also a kind of a literary arena of the political. So you know, we were just talking about how controversial Gomorrah is, and the major the major blame we have today, and also a kind of headache for anyone who want to study Gomorrah really seriously, is that Gomorrah changes his positions in his writing, in his focus of in his focus of creation, from literature to politics, and then to historiography, and from his aesthetic styles, from poetry to drama, and finally back to classical literature. It's something that is so flexible and so kind of constant that one can hardly come in terms with it. So I think that origin can be its origin can be found in Goethe's early romanticism. And this early romanticism is also very controversial, not in the political sense, but in a kind of stylistic sense. That is, in our age, you know, that kind of highly lyrical romanticism seems a little bit embarrassing. You know, when we think about literature, when we want to read a good poem from journals like Paris Review or New Yorker, we don't expect that kind of apostrophic gesture. That is, my earth, the Pacific. You know, you don't see that kind of Whitmanian kind of heroic. Or Shelleyan, the kind of romantic, sentimental image of the self. But that's how modern Chinese poetry started with Gomorrah, and Guo really contributed this lyrical self-image to this very new tradition in Chinese literature. And for me, this moments that may seem embarrassing to contemporary readers might be the place where we can find the secrets of that lyrical politics. And that's why, you know, Gomorrah eventually emerged as a kind of a lyrical voice and evolved into so many other domains and arena of intellectual, literary, and political creativity. I think apostrophe is something out of date for us, but its logic of calling calling upon the name of the sublime and identifying yourself with a larger world is a kind of condition, a literary condition for the whole kind of process of China's self-transformation in the 20th century.
I think you bring out well there the fact that so often, all the way through this book and all the way through Guo's life, it's kind of as though everything is always going on at once. You have multiple sort of layers of artifacts from different literary styles, from different historical periods, from different political traditions, often all kind of present in the life, at least the way it seems to me, having read it. They're all kind of jostling within his sort of life world simultaneously. And I think that, as you say, perhaps furnishes us with a sense of where a lot of this later complication and seemingly maddening flexibility comes from. You kind of discussed some of this early poetic work as being part of the emergence of ideas of revolutionary literature within this tradition of May the 4th movement, which of course celebrating an important anniversary this year, and also the emergence of the idea of a zeitgeist, or the Shi Dai Jing Shen,
yes,
Chinese version of it. Could you say a bit more? I mean, this is obviously relevant to the sort of specifically German dimension to his creative work. What is this zeitgeist thing? How does Guo understand this, and what does this sort of say about Chinese politics at the time?
Yeah, so like I mentioned in the introduction, of course, Zeitgeist was a keyword of German Romanticism and historicism. So eventually, according to many cultural and intellectual historians, Zeitgeist, the spirit of the times, the spirit of the age, has become part of modern historical consciousness. That is, we believe that there is an essential kind of a spirit of this or that period of time. So, of course, you know, in our kind of postmodernist context, we feel, wow, this is too much essentialism. It's Zeitgeist. It's definitely not some kind of ideology we would like to embrace in our own kind of historical thinking anymore. But for Gomorrah's generation, and for the whole kind of revolutionary period of 20th century China, Zeitgeist was the key word. And it really summarized the major kind of motive and drive toward change, toward a transformation, toward revolutionary, radical kind of remaking of self and society. So I wanted to uncover this word, this key word from that historical period, not to recuperate its value, but to use it as a kind of lens to examine that historical period, especially how this concept was conjured up and conceptualized in the works of Guo and the like-minded Chinese. So think about this German word. Zeit means time, and Geist means spirit. So actually, what did revolutionary Chinese intellectuals think of the time, and what did they think of the spirituality? So these are the interesting questions. And in the first, chapter one, you know, the link I wanted to point to is Guo Mongruo's deep identification with the work of Shelley. And we know that in Shelley's In Defense of Poetry, a very important poetic romantic theoretical writing. Shelley believes poetry is the unconscious manifestation of the spirit of the age. So we have this English version of the Zeitgeist. And Guo Mongruo takes one step further in his use of Shelley's concept. That is, we can be the conscious manifestation of the spirit. That is, we can be the revolutionary voice. And this is the most fascinating part, because we know that for the Romantics, the dominant, for British Romantics, the dominant metaphor is the lyre, is the wind harp. So the wind, the history, will give us music, and the poets are the instruments. And for Guo Mongruo and many other Chinese romantic revolutionary writers, their metaphor is gramophone. So it's a more kind of technically modernized version of the instrument. But we see, when we look at this metaphor, it's interesting, because you become an instrument of the revolution. But at the same time, by becoming somehow an instrument, you attain self-consciousness. So this, on the one hand, you don't have your own ego. On the other hand, your ego is sublimated. Your ego attains the highest kind of consciousness. I think that can be traced back to the apostrophic gesture. That is, I want to identify with the universe. I want to identify with the revolution I want to identify was in Shelley's, the West Wind, let me be you. And then that means I'm no longer myself. I don't have my ego. But on the other hand, that means my ego is empowered. So I think that politics is at the root of China's imagination of what is the spirit of the age. And the answer is that's the revolutionary change. The revolutionary change being the spirit of the age. And you need to be the instrument of that revolutionary change.
Mm. It's absolutely fantastic the way you kind of recover some sense of the immediacy and the vividness, I guess, of that of that experience. Because of course, as we've already mentioned, what subsequently happened made it quite easy to forget that there was this real romanticism, this lyricism at the beginning of everything. Maybe later got very clouded with all kinds of other pretty devastating events, of course. Moving into chapter two, you really provide, I think, a very powerful sense with the context of the era, and you give a really good biographical sense of how it was that Gore was so embedded in the age, if you like. You know, you provide a lot of very rich detail of what was going on in his personal life and how this was influencing his expanding intellectual and political outlook. So I'd point listeners in the direction of that, because it kind of provides a great pair for this sense of how terms like Zeitgeist were coming to have relevance for him. And you also give another really great account of the Gore and the Creation Society, his sort of some of his intellectual confreres of the time, and some of the other German terms that they brought into Chinese, many of them sort of transcribed via sound rather than meaning, as Zeitgeist was. And it again gives a really vivid sense of the way that these ideas were moving from German and English thinking and indeed poetry and politics and everything into Chinese at the time. Words that subsequently died out or were replaced by Japanese borrowings and so on. Again, we don't really have time to go into that so much in detail, but I just highlight it along the way. And then I thought that we could go on to chapter three here, where you really get into this really life work of Gore in the translation sphere, that is Goethe's Faust, which he spent 30 years of his life, spanning the decades from 1919 and all the way up to 1949. You say an awful lot about this process of translation, including about language and poetic form, and how there may even within this be a missing link between the classical language Wenyan that was more normal for Chinese writing in the long ago and Baihua, the kind of everyday use of Chinese. Could you say more about Gore's use of language in his translation of Faust?
Yeah, so basically chapter two is also a kind of preparation for chapter three. And in general, if there, you know, history, revolutionary history, considered as a Zeitgeist, actually was experienced and recorded in Guo's translation and other translingual practice as a kind of figuration of that traumatic discontinuity, a sudden stop, a kind of caesura and failures. It's not as smooth as the term Zeitgeist seems to indicate. So it's not a kind of essential triumphal kind of progression toward a goal at all. So likewise, in language, I think Gomo, I really want to be microscopic in chapter three, because we really need to zoom in onto Guo's poetic linguistic choices in this text of three decades in making. So the translation of Goethe's Faust becomes a powerful record of the change of Chinese poetic language over the most traumatic revolutionary periods in modern Chinese history. And I think Guo tried to be a creative and flexible through and through, but he also evolved quite a lot. And I recover some early kind of forgotten fragments of his translation of Goethe's Faust. And we can see there his poetic language is quite unstable. And that was the age when vernacular new literature and the literary revolution was just at its beginning. Mm-hmm. And then in 1927, when he finished his translation of Goethe's Faust Part One, we see he really felt self-accomplished. He became really confident in his language, and indeed, we saw some we see some good examples of how a more vernacular but elegant Chinese poetic language. But it doesn't mean that this unstable nature of a poetic language disappeared. And in his translation of Goethe's Faust Part Two, in which Goethe mobilizes so many, so diverse forms of European poetic traditions, Guo Moruo had to come up with some really makeshift solutions in Chinese in order to accommodate the diversity of Goethe's poetic experiment. So all these moments for me are really valuable because this is also part of a very important aspect of Chinese Revolution. That is the transformation of the poetic language.
And well, and Guo, as you mentioned, is someone kind of uniquely equipped to adapt himself to this sort of transformation because of his training, his linguistic abilities,
right,
and so on. But you're dealing there, I guess, with two very shifting fields of you know, a source in which Goethe himself is experimenting with a lot of forms and you know, deploying a lot of literary complex and diverse literary devices, and then Guo's sort of output of a translation is also dealing with a shifting field of language and everything else in a very, very different context.
I mean, you know, I learned German back in my graduate school at NYU, but I learned it simply in order to pass my examination, simply in order to qualify for complete PhD examinations. So eventually, when I work on when I worked on this chapter, you know, I took pain with the two languages. You know, I had to say, you know, that's where I learned a lot, and I eventually felt my own kind of linguistic existence enriched by both Goethe and Guo Moruo. But I would like to leave it to the judgment of the reader to say whether Guo Moruo's translation is a successful one, especially if we look back from today's perspective. You might find a lot of shortcomings in the hindsight, but if you compare to Goethe's original, you started to have more and more kind of understanding of Guo Moruo's decisions.
Right, right, and in a way, looking at it in its own context, as you do, is what reveals that that complexity. But that's brilliant. We'll move on perhaps to part two now, and more the sort of interpretive, translingual, as you borrow this term from Lydia Liu, and the kind of an interpretive side of Guo's activities and his politics, creativity. You start off in chapter four by discussing his kind of obsession, really, with history and with quite distant pasts, even in a revolutionary era, which you also mention is in some ways something of an anti-historical period. So what was this kind of obsession with the deeper history that you see in Guo's kind of mindset, and how did it manifest itself in both his sort of creative output and also his autobiography?
I think, you know, in the first chapter of part two, I really wanted to do something experimental. So in part one, I cover the whole trajectory of Guo Monroe's translation of Goethe's Faust. Guo Monroe's Faust, that is Fu Shide in Chinese, eventually for us becomes an allegorical field of the revolutionary age. That is the Chinese revolution and its tensions really flared up in the field of language and translation. But I don't want to stop there. I want to go further to enlarge my scope to another mode of translation, that is the translation between revolution and ancient history, translation between revolution and antiquity. So this is very counterintuitive because, you know, I think that at least that's the case for my generation, that we got this conventional idea of the whole process of the long Chinese revolution was about how to fight, how to negate Chinese tradition, especially its ancient heritage. But in the case of Guo Monroe, because Guo Monroe was the best or worst representative of this revolutionary spirit, we can start to ask then why, you know, Guo Monroe was also so fascinated with antiquity, mm-hmm. and why he devoted himself to a kind of really interesting leftist scholarship of antiquity. That is not to entirely negate the antiquity, but to transform the antiquity into a revolutionary discourse. So I see that kind of transcoding also as a kind of translation. That's definitely a kind of conceptual leap forward I would like to take, but it's up to you to judge whether it's good or not. But when he was writing his autobiography, he was doing his exile in Japan in the late 20s and early 30s. He was also doing his Marxist studies of the pre-Qing period of China. That is the period, the half-mythical, half-historical period of Xia, Sheng, and Zhou. And he was working on his original contributions to archaeological philology. So I wanted to bring these two works into conversation in chapter four. And eventually, you see, basically, Guo Monroe was using the same kind of terminology, writing both autobiography and historical scholarship.
Mm. That gives a sense of the way that, again, those sort of things simultaneously, constantly circulate in his mind and in what he's producing.
Yeah, and then in chapter four, you know, the question is that he used historical drama as a major kind of genre, and he basically reinvented this this modern genre of historical drama at the service of revolution. And finally, in chapter six, it is about his translation of ancient Chinese poetry into vernacular Chinese poetry. So I think, you know, finally in chapter six, I think I'm in my safe haven of translation, because you see, between classical Chinese and vernacular Chinese, there is this a transcoding process of translation. And for many people will say, okay, that's totally common sense practice. That is, in order to understand classical Chinese materials, you need that kind of vernacularization. But for Gomoruo, it was from classical Chinese poetry into vernacular Chinese poetry. He wanted to retain the poeticness of the classical language in vernacular translation. So that was even more interesting and challenging. And that's where I see this kind of conversation, transformation between antiquity and revolution, also as a form of translation.
Right. And it is exactly as you say, it is a kind of conversation. I mean, perhaps appropriately for a Marxist figure, that there is a kind of dialectical exchange going on there where, as you mentioned, you bring out in chapter five, these allegorical reworkings, these plays that he kind of put together in the 40s, 50s and 60s, which draw on rich classical themes, but draw kind of concepts from them, but also inject into them ideas of the people, the Renmin, the kind of these revolutionary ideas that were current at the time. And as you say too, this chapter six brings into sort of curious dialogue or simultaneity, almost these ancient classical works of classical poetry. I think one really interesting point you make there is that it's not so much the case that this is just an update or a bringing forward of these things, because of course, vernacular Chinese as a written form has its own long history. It's existed simultaneously and for a long time. It's not just that it's a new version of the old thing. So it's a bit more complicated a process than just let's bring this forward into the new version of Chinese that we now have. And I think you highlight these things really, really well, and how rooted they are, as we've discussed throughout, in the moment, in the time which Guo is deeply embedded. But finally, in this sort of frame of the classical form and how it was so tangled up with Guo's politics, you bring out in the conclusion this dialogue with Mao that you brought up right at the beginning, and this sort of battle of classical verse that the two were engaged with right at the end of both of their lives. Could you say something about what this was and what? Yeah, it just seems like a novel quirk, but perhaps not so much given the longer history of Guo's activities.
Sure, yeah, and that's also the most scandalous and most perilous part of Guo's life. That was his poetic conversation with Mao Zedong in the 60s and 70s. And, I leave this question to the very end of the book, but that's where, I think the theme of part two really can be driven home. That is, why, this has been on my mind all the time. Why the Chinese Revolution, the most radical wing of the Chinese Revolution, was also deeply preconditioned in a constant reinterpretation of the ancient. So think about why Marxist historical scholarship was so important in the 30s. Think about why historical drama was so important in the 40s and 50s. And now in the 60s and 70s, Guo Moruo started this poetic conversation with Mao Zedong himself. And basically, Mao made the initial move. And from the perspective of political benefits, we can simply say, good for you, Guo. Mao Zedong liked you. But then my question, as someone who's trained in modern Chinese modernism, I got immediately alerted, because Guo, you are the founding father of vernacular free verse Chinese modern poetry, and now you ended up writing classical style poetry with Mao Zedong. And remember, that kind of poetic conversation was typical of literati gentry aesthetics and lifestyle. And the most controversial part, of course, came in 1973, when Mao Zedong wrote a poem criticizing Guo Moruo's leftist historical scholarship produced back in the 1940s. So this was not only the form. The form was classical Chinese poetic qi lü. It was not only about the form, but also about the content, the subject matter of their conversation composed in poetic form. They were talking about the first emperor of Qin and then Confucius, right. Who was the true, quote-unquote, spirit of ancient Chinese times, the emperor or the Confucius, the sage. Mm. So they ended up talking about intellectual history and political history, but according to Mao and Guo, this highly scholarly ancient topic was also the most important subject matter for revolution. So there you see this totally confusing combination of the ancient and the revolution. So that's why it's also very scandalous, because Mao's poem could be used and was used as the final verdict on intellectual, political, and personal subject matters.
Well, I think that's right. It does at first glance seem absurd and deeply confusing. The fact that, yeah, as you say, Qin Shi Huang and Confucius, they're almost like living characters in the lives of Mao and Guo at this point, which seems so odd given the recent sort of, or given what had happened in the decades up to that point. But I think you help us really appreciate why, you know, you make it less of a scandal in a sense. I mean, you don't justify it, but you do provide us with all the tools for understanding where this came from. It doesn't seem quite so shocking.
Yeah, I think that kind of anachronistic dimension of the Chinese Revolution needs to be brought up for further discussion.
Mm. Well, I think you do a great job of that. And we haven't quite had time, of course, to delve into all the wonderful complexity and nuance of the book. And we've moved through chapters 4 to 6, the second part, somewhat quickly there. But I hope that listeners will pick up a copy and really, really delve into this work of tremendous richness and fascination. But Pu, in the meantime, we have taken up quite a bit of your time here today.
My pleasure.
So, before we go, though, I'll just ask, what is it you're up to these days? I mean, what do you have on your plate in your kind of current projects?
My current new project is also a kind of return to earlier interest, but also a kind of a new path. So during my Peking University years, I worked on modernist Chinese poets, and some of them traveled quite a bit during the wartime in the late 30s and early 40s. And the poetic works they wrote during the war and travel became something I worked on back then. But then when working on the Gomoro project, I started to read a lot of travelogues written by Gomoro himself, but I didn't have a chance to discuss Gomoro's travel writings in my first book. So eventually I started to conceive of my second book project as a study of travel writings in the same time frame, that is China's revolutionary decades. So that will be my first second project, and I'm still on a really early stage of archival research and textual analysis. So I would like to have you any of your feedback. Yeah,
well, that's wonderful. I can't wait to see the output of that, because I think that will bring a geographical diversity into what is already a topic of enormous scope. Fantastic, Pu. Thank you so much for being on the show today. It was really excellent to have the chance to talk to you.
Yeah, my pleasure here.
And listeners, thank you too for listening, as ever, to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast channel on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you very soon. Goodbye.